Commissioner has called the order. It's 8:04. It is March the 23rd. And we have present for the record Representatives Coghill, Dahlstrom, Anderson, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We have five items on the agenda today, and I intend to go in this order. First, the confirmation hearing for Chief Administrative Law Judge, Ms. Terry Thurbin, who's here in the audience with us today. Second, we will go to Amarada Hess, HB 187. Third, we will go to HB 188. Fourth, we will go to House Bill 91 by our own good member, Representative Coghill. And finally, House Bill number 219, Strangulation Crimes. It's my intent, hopefully, that we get through all of them and get them out of here. So without further ado, Ms. Thurbin, if you'd come forward. Welcome to House Judiciary.
Thank you.
Tell us why you want to do, why you want to be the Chief Administrative Law Judge.
Well, for the record, I'm Terry Thurbin. I'm presently the Acting Chief Administrative Law Judge for the Office of Administrative Hearings. I've been working in that capacity since November 1st, and I'm finding that it is every bit as challenging as I expected, and that was the thing that drew me to the position in the first instance, was that the opportunity to work as an administrative law judge in the office would have been great at some point down the road, but the best opportunity is to kick it off, correct, to get it off on the right footing, to work on the regulations projects, the case management, development of the office procedures and all those sorts of things. And that was the attraction, and I have a background in administrative law, among other things, including some of the ancillary functions of the office, such as training. I taught legal research and writing. I also worked at the Institute for Administrative Justice in my early days of my legal career, and seemed like the background I had was driving me in the direction of this position.
Fantastic. Well, we've got your curriculum vitae, and it's got amazing set of accomplishments on it, and I don't have any questions. Representative Coghill.
Just a comment, and first of all, thank you. I think to step up to this, it is going to be a challenge, there's no doubt about it, because you're going to see some interesting things. But our intention was to create an administrative hearing process that I think is going to give us a good venue. And I guess I would be interested in future date, since you get to see it from the inception, how some of the technical sides of the law, as we work the system, either work or don't work. I think it would be interesting from your perspective, having kind of assembled it and then operate it for a while. It would be interesting if, and I would ask the chairman to consider asking you back maybe in a year or so, to find out how the process actually is, in fact, working, and if we hit the nail on the head statutorily.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
Through the Chair, Representative Coghill, I'd be more than happy to come back at any time, and the legislation does call for my office to produce an annual report to the legislature and the governor that's submitted each January 31st. The first report, if you've seen it, was kind of skimpy because we'd only been in operation about a month, but I fully anticipate that we'll be watching throughout the course of this year and every year for suggestions for changes, statutory changes and other changes that will make the process more efficient.
And I would anticipate the report. However, there's nothing like a personal hearing, I think, helps us put that in an exclamation, especially since this is going to be a new system to us.
That's a fantastic idea. We do. We sure hope it works. Through the years, my first committee I chaired was Administrative Regulatory Review Committee, and the frustration on the part of the people who do have challenges to some of the administrative processes is it's really compelling to hear, and people just sort of feel they don't have a place to go to and to vent those concerns, and so this was a really good, or at least the best idea that the legislature could come up with. So we wish you well, and we look forward to hearing a report from you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, hearing none. Anybody here in the audience to testify on the confirmation hearing of Ms. Terry Thurbin? Anybody online? Okay, hearing none, public testimony is closed. That brings it back before us. Representative Coghill?
Sure. Madam Chair, I'd like to recommend that the committee forward to the full body for consideration the confirmation of Terry Thurbin to the administrative law hearing justice. What is it? What's the actual?
Chief Administrative Law Judge. Okay, is there any objection to forwarding that name on to the full body? Okay, hearing none, the name will be forwarded. Thank you for your time. And next, we will move on to Amrata Hess. And it is not my intent to do much more in terms of a hearing today. What I would like to do, and I have discussed with my members, is to get these two vehicles moving out of this committee, which both of these were referred to this committee only to review the legal opinion. And so we had a full discussion about that, about the fact that the statute was put into effect to realize an agreement that there might be some kind of bias on the part of a jury pool in the future. So the legislature chose, as a result of Amrata Hess, to put a statute into place. We've analyzed that, thoroughly discussed it as a Judiciary Committee. And I have respectfully requested my committee members to accommodate me in forwarding on both of these pieces of legislation to the Finance Committee, where the full analysis will take place about whether or not these will be used as tools for the capital budget, to what extent they will, and so on. I want to state on the record that, and Representative Dahlstrom will make her own comments, but there are members that have individual concerns about this, that want to know more about it, and they are graciously accommodating me today. Just a reminder that in allowing this to move out, you can put a do not pass, you can put an amend, you can put a do pass, you can put a no rec, whatever you should choose. I want to thank the department for being patient. We've had this both of these here in the committee for a couple of weeks. I sure appreciate that. And with that, I just want to know if there's any more testimony from members. Representative Coghill.
Just to make the motion, Madam Chair.
Okay, and so.
Do I make them individually?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'd move that we move House Bill 187 out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, the bill is moved with individual recommendations from committee members. Okay, Representative Coghill.
Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 188 out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes.
There is a fiscal note. Okay, is there an objection to the movement of House Bill number 188 out of this committee and on to finance? Okay, hearing none, House Bill 188 is moved. Okay, next we have House Bill number 91, Indecent Exposure to Minors. Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for hearing this bill. What I thought I'd do is have one of my staff members give the introduction to the bill, and then I can begin answer any questions, and we do have some testimony here, and then I'll pick it up from there.
Okay.
So, she ran out. Well, that's all right. I'll just pick up.
Okay.
I'm sure this bill, you'll hear some testimony today, starts from a situation where we had somebody indecently expose themselves to a minor, and then found again in two different places in the interior, found out that he could plea bargain down to a misdemeanor. Well, look who's here.
Yes. Vanessa's just let me know as well that there's muffins and banana bread over there behind you. So.
Well, in that case, what I'll do is I'll defer to my staff.
Pass the baton back.
While the camera's off of me.
What a strategy. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. I was upstairs and thought I had this all perfectly in order. Was heading down. So Amrata has been faster than I thought.
Okay.
What I'd like to do is read the sponsor statement for House Bill 91. And as the representative was speaking, he stated that we had a particular incident where several girls, young girls in Delta Junction, were subjected to a man exposing himself to them in the parking lot of a local store last summer. He was apprehended and arrested. In a background check, it was reported that he had a prior conviction of a similar incident in Arizona. When arrested in the Arizona case, police reported that he matched the description of a man reported for the same activity several times, but they had never been able to catch him. In the Delta Junction incident, the local magistrate charged him with 3 felonies, but because of the circumstances, he could not be convicted of a felony. He plea bargained down to 1 misdemeanor. Children are more vulnerable and innocent than adults, and children fall prey to sex offenders more easily than adults. This legislation makes repeat convictions of indecent exposure within the observation of a person under the age of 16 a felony. So, as we have the change would be in adding section to 41-458, the offender has been previously convicted under this section or 1141-460A or a law or ordinance of this or other jurisdiction with elements similar to a crime under this section or AS 1141-460A. So it's before you here.
I was telling Representative Coghill that in part of the reporting on this recent tragedy with this young girl in Florida, that they were talking about the fact that this individual that committed this heinous crime started out with a series of check kiting and shoplifting and so on, but the first gateway crime, if you will, the first evidence of his future was in indecent exposure. And he was caught a number of times for that. And it was really difficult to hear the testimony of the father saying, you know, this is a 20-year criminal. And, yeah, the things were all kind of petty along the way, but didn't anybody see this coming? And it was all in kind of the same county. But I think this is a really great bill, and it's very timely. The more that we learn about sex offenders, we had a presentation as well. Was it last week or the week before? Week before. On this containment model, and this subject came up as well. One of the women that was here, it's difficult to listen to. It's an uncomfortable topic, but she talked a lot about the gratification that comes from that for these individuals. It's a deviant sort of way of looking at the world, and she was in her vehicle, and somebody drove by and exposed himself to her. And she said, you know, the more that I know now, I'm certain that he spent his whole day doing that. Mm. You know, that it was just this pattern, and then it leads on. You know, once the rush of that is over, you kind of go to the next level and the next and the next. So I really appreciate yourself and the sponsor's willingness.
Grandson, so it's very important legislation to me, too. So I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, and thanks for rushing back down.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just to let you know, the 1141-460, if with the permission, I'll just read that section, the 1141-460A is an offender commits the crime of indecent exposure in the second degree if the offender knowingly exposes the offender's genitals to the presence of another person with reckless disregard for the offensive, insulting, and frightening effect the act may have. So that's the if they're previously convicted under that. I'm not one that really enjoys ratcheting things up to a felony level. I think it's where sometimes make it easier to become a felon and harder not to become a felon, you know. However, it seems such an egregious thing to me that somebody can be just treated as a misdemeanor under the conditions that this bill would demand. So I just wanted to make sure that on the 460, I'm sorry, it was clear. And with that, we do have one lady here to testify.
Yes.
At least one.
Welcome, Debbie Jocelyn. And then we also have Tamara DeLucia and Annie Carpinetti.
Sorry. Thank you, Representative McGuire. For the record, my name is Debbie Jocelyn, and I'm from Delta Junction. And this is a bill that I'm sorry that I have any testimony on. But last summer, it was my children who were exposed to this man in Delta Junction. My daughters, who were at the time 7 and 2 years old, were with my husband, and he had run into the store for just a moment and said, "Wait right here." And, gee, it seemed like such an innocent thing to do. And this man pulled up in a car next to ours, opened his passenger's door, and turned around sideways and pulled down his pants and began to gyrate around in front of my daughters. And they were thoroughly frightened. And because his hand never touched his penis, it was not masturbation. And so he was charged with a misdemeanor. At the beginning, the judge charged him with 3 felony counts. My husband came out to the car, saw this also, so there were 3 people who saw him, and he was originally charged with 3 felony counts of indecent exposure. But it's not masturbation, but it's not masturbation if his hand didn't touch his penis, and so he got off. I went to the hearing to represent my children and their rights, and I explained to them that this man obviously has been around. He followed a 6-year-old girl of the toy department at the Walmart and did the same thing to them. And he knew how to masturbate, if you will, without using his hands. He knew that as long as his hands were up here, he was okay for a misdemeanor, and he apparently knew the law. It's totally, totally frightening for my children. My 2-year-old is still afraid to go back to that store, and she still occasionally talks about a man with his pants down. We call him the yucky guy at our house, and it's a picture that they're not going to get rid of easily. And it's not long after, there was a man in Fairbanks, and he matched the description just about of the guy in Delta. It was a different man, but both men in their 50s. You know, not children, not young kids out pulling pranks, men in their 50s who are out purposely looking for children. Not just anybody do they want to do this to, but they're looking for children. And I appreciate, Representative McGuire, you bringing up this man in Florida, because I noticed that too, that was in his past, indecent exposure to children. And it should be a red flag to us that when someone does this, they've got even more disgusting things in mind to do at some later date. We can only guess when. And I think that we do need to make this a felony. It's not right that this man was let off so easily with just one misdemeanor when the effects are so horrible for children, and robbing them of their innocence is such a serious matter.
Was it, Debbie, brought up that he had been convicted in the past, or
it certainly was,
and still only received him
right in Arizona when this happened, and they realized that this is probably the man they had been looking for in other instances, and still what he got there was counseling, and here they wanted to counsel him again. And I'm not against counseling the man, but I also think that this is a crime that deserves some real punishment. And I was told that I was overreacting, that I should ratchet it down and stay more calm about this. In fact, the DA's office told me that I should just explain to my children that some people do naughty things. But I haven't come to the DA's office or to this legislature, you know, for advice on how to parent my children. I'm asking you to, you know, help me to explain to them why should a man walk away free after he's done that to little kids? You know, that's the thing I had trouble explaining to them. So I would just ask for you to consider passing this bill. I think it's very important, and I think that the state of Alaska needs to take a very dim view of this kind of activity.
Representative Guerra.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thanks for bringing this to us. The bill seems fairly tailored. Doesn't seem like an overly broad reaction to the situation. It seems fine as written. So I appreciate your answer.
You two are in agreement again. Amazing.
We're still on the same side of the table.
Yeah. Is there? Well, let me get real quick. There's 2 more people that want to testify. Tamara Delucia. Tamara, are you there?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Tamara Delucia with the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights, and my office did work on this case that was referred to you. This bill arose from a case that OVR handled, wherein 2 little girls were victims of an indecent exposure perpetrated, as you already heard, by an offender with priors for indecent exposure in another jurisdiction. In that case, the actual conduct of the offender didn't qualify for felony level conduct because the law as it was written at the time required a very particularized conduct, which oftentimes little girls can't explain to a police officer that's what they witnessed. But I think we all kind of understood that might have been what was happening, but it was not particularized enough to be alleged in the police report so as to allow the district attorney to charge felony level conduct, as frustrating as that was. And I believe the magistrate took it quite seriously seriously, but the hands of the DA were tied in that this law was very particular as requiring certain conduct to be a felony. But the individual who was increasing his predatory conduct was clearly a danger to the community. The idea of making multiple like-kind offenses a felony is not unique in this state. Most notably, as you are all familiar, DUI offenses will amount to felony conduct by virtue of multiple acts of what otherwise would be misdemeanor conduct. So misdemeanors carry a maximum sentence of 1 year in jail, which I don't believe provides enough penalty, particularly where you have a sexual predator with a history of such offenses. Research does show these kinds of offenders do ratchet up their offenses and will continue to increase their predatory conduct, particularly where children are involved, and that is a very, very vulnerable population that we should protect. I urge this body to pass HB 91. Thank you.
Thank you, Tamara. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Okay, hearing none. Is there anybody else online? I only had Tamara's name. Okay. In the audience, Annie Carpinetti.
Madam Chairman, my name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the criminal division of the Department of Law, and we support this bill. And I hate to do this, but I was noticing as I was reading the sex offender registration statutes this morning that I think we need to do a technical change in 1263-106C4 to make sure that this is covered under sex offender registration law. Otherwise, there's some question about it being covered in the statute. So that's my only comment. We support the law, the bill. We appreciate the sponsor bringing it forward. But just to make sure that the people who are convicted under this provision have to register as sex offenders, we need to just make that technical change in sex offender registration law.
Representative Anderson.
You want me to make that conceptual amendment that we amend the bill to add 1263-100, subsection 6C4, to add this crime to the sex offender registration, and so move.
You need to just do some rewriting on that, because 458 is covered, but then 460 makes sex offender registration only for second offenders against children, and you want this for sex offenders for a second offense against any victim.
So. And I'll give Vanessa the site you gave, and that's my motion.
So it's conceptual.
Of course. I don't have it.
Okay. Is there an objection to that motion?
No objection. The question is when it gets to finance, if it has any finance implication, but I don't think that it would.
Okay. Okay. Hearing no objection, that conceptual amendment carries. Thank you, Annie, for that good suggestion. Is there anybody else here in the audience to testify on House Bill number 91? Okay. Hearing none, public testimony is closed. That brings the bill back before us. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move HB 91 version A with attached zero physical notes and individual recommendations.
Any objection to that motion? Okay. Hearing none, House Bill number 91 moves. Representative Kara.
I want to apologize to everybody for being late this morning. I've got another bill that I have to present in fisheries. All of the bills that were listed on today's calendar, I was going to have no problem passing out of committee today, including the strangulation bill that's coming up next, which I might not be here for. There were two bills that were passed out before I got here, and I did want to make a comment on the record on those bills. I was going to let them pass out also.
Okay.
I think I agree with the chair that those two bills that had to do with using permanent fund earnings, the Amaretta Hess earnings, to fund a road construction bond. Largely, that has a finance implication. The judiciary implications, I think, were pretty narrow, so I see sending that to finance as an appropriate thing. But I do want to state on the record, I spent a lot of time with the folks from the Permanent Fund and Department of Revenue on this bill. That bond is essentially going to be funded this way. For roughly a $320 million road bond, we're going to take what's going to average about $30 million a year of permanent fund earnings out of the Amaretta Hess account to fund this bond. Over the course, it's going to be a 17-year bond, roughly. So that's $30 million a year, 17 years. It's going to be about $500 million in permanent fund earnings to fund this bond. I think the way they've structured it, they're going to get a good bond rate. And so that part doesn't concern me. What concerns me is spending a $500 million out of the permanent fund. I can't envision at this point supporting this bill when it reaches the floor. That's a lot of money to use from the permanent fund at a time where I don't think we have to without a public vote. So So I do have concerns about both of those bills, and somebody might try and talk me into changing my mind, but at this point I don't think it's a wise thing to do. Just one other thing. We've talked about this Amaretta Hess account, and the way the law is written, that Amaretta Hess money isn't supposed to be used for the permanent fund dividend, and that's fine. But that is not a green light to use that. While that money isn't supposed to be used for the dividend, that's not a green light to use that permanent fund money for state spending. Now, those are two separate questions. It's okay if you can't use the money for the dividend, but I don't think it's okay to take the money out of the permanent fund. So,
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Guerra, I appreciate your comments, and I echo many of the same things that you have just expressed, and the reason I was comfortable letting it go out of committee was because of the narrow purview that we do have with the judiciary issue, and I'm confident that finance will do the necessary research, and I don't know how I will be voting on that bill. I have deep concerns about the permanent funds, have made commitments to my constituents. I have been told in my office by folks from Cheryl Frasca's office that there is not a penny coming out of permanent fund earnings, that it's all Amaretta Hess and it's a totally separate fund. I will continue to research that, but I do feel confident that we did our job in committee with the narrow scope that we have. And those thoughts were expressed before you arrived, so I just wanted to share that.
Representative Crockill.
Just in balance to the discussion, there's certainly a question when you have something invested in the permanent fund, just like you do many other funds that the permanent fund manages, whether those earnings are the same earnings that pay out the dividend. And I think that there's a reasonable question here, and I expect to hear in the Finance Committee a little further vetting of that particular issue. But to say that they are just earnings of the permanent fund when they have never been commingled with the earnings that have paid out dividend, I think does raise enough question in my mind that we need to look at it. Now, the bonding issue, that's a totally different question in my view. Why would we go into debt when we could pay off a debt? And I think that's one of the questions that we'll be asking in the Finance Committee. So to make out that they are definitely earnings that are vested from the permanent fund, but they're not commingled with what is normally considered earnings of the permanent fund. And so that's a pretty clear distinction at this point, I think. But just that's the balance of that discussion, I think.
Madam Chair.
Great points. Representative Broomberg?
Yeah, I apologize for being late, too. I had quite a discussion, and I'm doing some additional research on that. The use of the term the fund doesn't clarify whether they're taking the money out of the corpus or out of the earnings. And I think that that's not particularly well drafted, and I may very well have some problems with that on the floor. And we're, as I say, we're conducting some research. And I also have some problems with them doing that quickly without really vetting that with the people of this state. I have suggested that they visit community councils and stuff like that, because people may very well think that that is an attempt to get into the permanent fund without a vote of the people. And this is something that we have never done, never used the money in the permanent fund to collateralize. They don't like that term, but that's what it is. Well, it's not technically, but to put up in some manner, to finance in some manner, the issuance of a large amount of bonds, and it's a significant precedent. So at this point, until I do those, complete those steps and am satisfied politically and legally and economically for what Representative Coghill said, I don't plan to support it on the floor.
Those are all good points, and just my points on the record, I don't know that I've ever made any, but I think that at some point, whether it's this year or years in the future, though, the legislature will need to decide whether or not the pot of money that is Amaretta Hess will be used for something. Because as it stands right now, it is clear that it is separate from the payout of the dividend, and it has been a separate contained pot that just continues to earn money on top of itself. And it's not that we need to spend every dollar we have, for sure. I think those are legitimate questions. How much do we want in the way of a capital budget? Is $340 million the appropriate figure? Is that the figure simply because that's the amount in the Amarillo Hess fund, or is it the figure because it's the right figure? Those are all really important questions. But with respect to the bonding part, I think, you know, why borrow for the future? I used to, sadly, for me, my first clerking in a law firm was bonding. Sorry if Tom Klinkner's listening, but there is a way to get more out of your money when you do that. In a time when interest rates are really good, like they are right now, you can really amortize your money. But all that will be discussed by people brighter than me, like this guy right here, Representative Hawker, who's going to get up here and try to talk judiciary. I'm very much looking forward to it. And then in terms of the vote of the people, you know, we've had this debate and we'll continue to have it. I still really believe that we're a representative government and we are sent here to vote for the people in our district. And every time we have to come back to them to analyze really complex, thorough issues when they're busy working, taking their kids to and from school, trying to be citizens and all the things that they do when they aren't elected to office, every time we come back to them and say, make this decision for us, I question whether or not that is truly a representative democracy anymore. And we've had these debates, and there's no reason to get back into it, but that's just my thoughts on the record.
Madam Chair,
Representative Groomer,
it's not just the question of getting into the permanent fund, but this is a way of getting floating a lot of bonds that would normally be GO bonds.
That's true.
And under a different provision of the Constitution, because they put up the full faith and credit, they'd have to go under the Constitution to the people. So this is a way of end running votes to the people under two different theories.
That's a good point. Representative Guerra.
Just finally, there, and I spent a lot of time on this outside of this committee, because it was presented to me early on that somehow the Amarillo Hess money is different than permanent fund money, and therefore it's okay to bond with this money. And this is my understanding, and this is one of the reasons I oppose use of it. I don't believe it is different than permanent fund money. The Amarillo Hess money is money that came into the state as part of an oil tax settlement. The money was going to go into the permanent fund in order to settle an argument many years ago about whether or not this money should be used for the dividend, because the oil companies were taking the position that if it was used for the dividend, it would influence the jurors in that case, and therefore it shouldn't go into the dividend. And so they settled that by saying this money shouldn't go into the dividend. That was fine. That's a separate question from whether or not this money is part of the fund. It was always intended back then to be part of the fund. It is part of the fund, and the only reason it's segregated is because of this legal argument that existed many years ago about whether or not the money should go into the dividend and therefore possibly influence the judge and the jurors in that case. So what we really have is about $400 million that's part of the permanent fund. It's only segregated because of this legal argument from many years ago, but whether it's part of the fund or not, that question, it is part of the fund. And so you face the same question whether you're talking about the Amarillo Hess part of the permanent fund or other parts of the permanent fund, which is it time to spend permanent fund earnings? Is it time? And I'm more confident than I guess Representative Groomberg is, though I'd like to hear the answers to his questions. I think they're only using permanent fund earnings, the Amarillo
Hess. But I'm not totally sure.
But I'm glad you're going to follow up on that. But the logical argument, is it time to use the permanent fund? That's a philosophical argument that we've had in this body for many, many years. I don't think that argument changes any just because this is the Amarillo Hess part of the permanent fund. So the question really is the same question whether it's Amarillo Hess or not Amarillo Hess. Is it time to use the permanent fund? Is it time to start spending earnings? So I just wanted to share at least that view on
the only flaw in that, and the only flaw in that is simply that, you know, if it is part of the permanent fund and it is part of the earnings reserve, and it can't go into dividends, I mean, that brings you back to the same question of what do you do with it, and should the money simply be sitting there earning interest for no logical purpose that we can see? And so, and I understand you have legislation, Representative Guerra, that would put it back in, and those are questions. But I appreciate your candor, because at the root of it is the fundamental question that you come back to, in terms of this state's resources that are available to us, how we spend, what type of fiscal plan we're going to have, whether it's more logical to have an income tax than it is to use part of the earnings reserve, whether it's appropriate to build things in our state with a pool of money that we have that isn't going into the dividend. These are all really great questions. But Representative Coghill.
I don't remember what the settlement amount was that was installed in this Amerita-Hess account, that the permanent fund, but it was just under $400 million, I believe. And so it has earned and grown significantly, I think. So and the fact that the member to my right here has a bill that would put it back in shows that it's not in. Anyway, we'll have that discussion.
I love it. I love it.
Just to correct, there's somebody else who has a bill. It's not my bill.
Oh, okay.
And it's to say that money can be used for the dividend.
Let's wrap up here so just, we can get to speculation.
Just on one other thing, and I would feel kind of remiss if I didn't speak on a different level about this.
Briefly, Representative Groenberg.
Yeah, really.
I've really allowed latitude for us to all speak, but we really are going to get to strangulation and get out of here. You are free to go to the finance hearings as well.
This really relates to this committee. I sat here in this room on this committee when this bill, that whole Amerita-Hess legislation came up. And I may have been the chair. I was either the majority leader or the chair. And one of the mistakes I made, one was on a workers' comp bill that I regret. And I'm coming to regret the way we dealt with this and maybe the constitutional budget reserve. These other two issues were kind of finance issues, just like this bill. And I kind of let that bill sail over my head, thinking that this was not a well-taken argument about disqualifying everybody in the state. And I didn't think enough to do a rule of necessity legislation, which would have cleared up the whole thing. Only the reason I haven't brought that other bill up, because it doesn't deal with juries. It should deal with juries as well as judges, that the rule of necessity should apply to everybody. And I'm going to take care of that and bring that to the committee. But we should have dealt with it like that rather than this tortured, non-fish nor fowl thing that we did with this large pot of money. And the only reason I'm saying that to the members of this committee is because if we move very quickly on things that aren't normally in our purview without really knowing what we're doing, then it could have a lot of consequences 20 years later. And I would not feel right in my own heart without sharing that with you.
Insightful. We'll keep an eye on those finance guys. Representative Hawker, welcome to House Judiciary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Mike Hawker.
Tell us about your bill.
You know, Madam Chair, quite frankly, I'd hope to spend my entire legislative career without an appearance before this committee. I would be much more comfortable discussing with you both the merits and the failings of the proposed Amerita-Hess legislation. But, you know, despite my anxiety of dealing with matters legislative, a constituent of mine, both who I know, both herself and her husband is a friend of mine I've known through years of working with Anchorage Police Department, and Ms. Tara Henry, who is with us today, is a forensic nurse, and her, amongst other things, outside of teaching around the state, she is a professional witness in many trials that involve forensic matters. Specifically, she came to me, and we had a long discussion on something that became so. She made such a compelling argument to me that I was willing to, frankly, step out of my own self-imposed prohibition against getting into matters judicial. Which is the issue of strangulation and how it is prosecuted in this state. You know, strangulation is clearly a major element in domestic violence, and Tara and the other folks here that I do have with me that can speak much more eloquently into the specifics of their experiences in court with this matter, it's very difficult to prosecute under our current assault statutes, which require the And again, not a court person, I will defer to my competent assistants here to present this better, but we don't have the, it's difficult to establish the serious injury criteria in order to prosecute strangulation as a felony. Strangulation, as I have learned speaking to my forensic professional, is something that quite can happen with really without leaving evidence of severe physical injury that could be entered into court as, as evidence. The request from the forensic community, the prosecution fraternity, the law enforcement community, and the state was to ask us as legislators to give the legal community the ability to prosecute cases of suffocation and strangulation as a felony, and being able to, by definition, say that if it is strangulation, it is a felony, and helping them deal with the hurdle of having to get through this serious physical injury criteria. And is without these physical injuries that these that may literally, I mean, you have someone that could be just seconds from death, but yet there's not an evidence of a physical injury. That these cases can still be, were being prosecuted as misdemeanors, not similar to the bill previously before us, where I don't think our intention as a legislature is to allow these to be prosecuted as a misdemeanor, but sometimes just the evidentiary standard is just a very difficult hurdle to overcome. With that brief introduction, I would ask perhaps for a more specific or answering questions, I would offer, I've got Ms. Tara Henry here, who is the competent professional. We've got Ms. Carbonetti with the Department of Law who concurs, and I believe we've got Tamara DeLucia with the Office of Victims' Rights also supporting this.
Thank you, Representative Hawker, and I just want to compliment you on your the way that you approach this whole issue. He's been working on this for months and approached it very cautiously and thoroughly and gathered all of the information from the various groups to find out you know, how he should approach it, and just the way that you represent your constituents so zealously as well. I know that that was the driving force for you to cross that line into the judicial area. And so, but welcome, and see, it's not so bad.
Thank you, Madam
and
Chair.
We're going to be nice to you. So.
You're also welcome in finance.
Yes, and I appreciate that. So thank you very much for your hard work on this, and Representative Kira.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I've thought of ways to try and torture you over there. But
that's a felony too, sir.
But actually, you deserve to be complimented over the way you did the bill. And this bill and the last criminal bill we just considered are examples of things that don't concern me that much. Very often somebody will have a very good idea. And they'll put it into a criminal bill, and they'll criminalize the part of the conduct they want to criminalize, but it'll be written in a way that also addresses this kind of conduct. And then so we always have to deal with the battle. Well, I know the bill is written overbroad, but it's hard to write completely narrowly. But we'll trust the prosecutors not to prosecute this when we only want them to prosecute this. But I think this is written well. It's as narrow as it needs to be. And we actually had our Judiciary Committee in my office last night with my aides and I, and we went through it, and it seems to be worded fine. So I appreciate it. I don't see any problem with the bill. I would just note this caution, and I'm going to note this periodically, maybe once a month, which is. There is a tendency, this is now my third year on the Judiciary Committee, there's a tendency for people to go through the criminal code and find crimes that we've already debated and decided what the appropriate penalty is, and then to sometimes up them. I don't think this is an example of where this is happening. I think this is a very appropriate bill, and I think the last bill was an appropriate bill. I think those are circumstances where the what's proposed in the bill makes sense. But I just, as we sort of get in the habit of just upping the sentence for particular crimes, let's always make sure that it's for the reason that's stated in these last two bills, which is there's a very compelling reason to do that. Sometimes it's too easy to just up everything. Because, I mean, once you're talking about a crime, by definition, you're talking about something that's very bad conduct. You're talking about something somebody should go to jail for. You're talking about something that somebody should be punished for. And so if somebody comes in and says, well, they should be punished more, it's hard to ever say no until everybody gets the death penalty, you know? And right.
So anyway, I just use your bill to talk about something completely different, but I think you did a good job, so thanks.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Representative Hawker.
I sincerely appreciate the comment and observation from Representative Guerra, but it's one of those where this is truly where we need to give credit where credit's due. This bill did take a great deal of effort to narrow it down, find a narrow focus that was not overbroad, did not criminalize things that weren't currently criminalized, but with sincere respect, this was the result of lengthy work, sincere effort by Ms. Henry, specifically with my staff, Julie Lucky, and the Department of Law, who we went through many approaches to this before this was finally arrived at, and again, Department of Law and Ledge Legal. So there were a lot of very talented legal minds and some very committed staff work, and we call it the public interest here at work. And it feels good, though, when you can say that the public process actually does work.
Every once in a while. Thank you very much, Representative Hawker. And so next we'll go to Ms. Tara Henry, your constituent and the impetus of the bill.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Tara Henry. I'm a forensic nurse, and as a forensic nurse, I perform medical forensic examinations on men and women who have been victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and I also assist the state medical examiner's office and do the forensic examination on homicide victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. I've been working in this area in Alaska for the last 9 years, and so I've seen hundreds of cases, and many of them involve strangulation. Strangulation is a very serious, sometimes fatal, physical force, and as Representative Hawker alluded to, a victim can become, so when they're being strangled, unconscious within seconds, and they can die within minutes if that pressure is continued. The problem is that because someone can become unconscious so quickly, oftentimes there is not any visible physical injuries on the surface of the neck. It is very difficult for a prosecutor to convince a jury that this person almost died, this was a life-threatening event, when the jury doesn't see any injuries, because we all want to see blood and cuts and bruises, and this is not something that we see often in strangulation. So historically, these cases have been charged as misdemeanor fourth-degree assaults. I've spent the last few years traveling around the state educating doctors, nurses, police, law enforcement, the prosecutors, advocates, in the pathophysiology and the signs and symptoms of strangulation, and educating the prosecutors that you can, there are symptoms that are present even when there's not a sign on the neck visibly. So recently, especially over the past year, prosecutors have been prosecuting these as felonies because the way our statute is written, they can still be prosecuted as felonies. However, it's very difficult, and so they always have to call in an expert, and so to explain to the jury why someone can be strangled and not have any injuries. I personally have been involved in homicide cases where the person was strangled completely to death, and there was no external injuries. I recently was involved in a case that the judge dismissed the grand jury indictment because the victim had testified about strangulation, but there wasn't anybody else there to explain why it was serious. So the prosecutor had to go back and re-indict that case with me testifying as to the seriousness. Basically, if I put my hands around your neck and I prevent oxygen from getting to your brain or carbon dioxide from getting out of your brain, I am literally controlling whether you live or die. And so if you pass this bill, it's going to help the prosecutors be able to use these cases and charge them as the felonies, prosecute them more easily. This is not a fourth-degree misdemeanor assault. It's not a simple slap on the arm. This is a life-threatening assault.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the work that you do. It's amazing to me. I'm sure the things that you see every day are very difficult, and none of us here want to do it, and I just thank you for what you do.
Thanks.
For all of us. Representative Coghill.
It's very interesting. So up to this point, then, it's been circumstantial that they have been relying on. So what are some of the symptoms that that are going to be more definite?
Well, basically, what the prosecutors, when they've had visible injuries, they've taken them forward as the felonies. But when they haven't, they didn't realize that there were other things that you can rely on. Things that happen in a strangulation, you have to know, did they have difficulty breathing? Were they hyperventilating? Did they vomit? Because oftentimes, someone who's been strangled, and then when the pressure has been released, they're gasping, trying to get air in. They get air into their stomach, they'll vomit. They, when they're going unconscious, they can urinate on themselves. They lose control of their bowel or their bladder. After they've been strangled, because of damage to the vocal cords, they can lose their voice. They may become hoarse for a few days. They have swelling in their neck. And the thing about strangulation is, even though, I mean, they're at immediate risk when the event is happening of dying, but there is lots of documented cases where the victims have died days or weeks later because of the damage to the at a cellular level to the brain cells. They've not been able to recover, and they end up dying, or their throat swells shut from the trauma to the internal muscles and the tissues of the neck, and they're not able to get to medical attention right away, and they've actually died days later. Women who are pregnant at the time that they are being strangled, oxygen's not getting to mom, it's not getting to the fetus, and so there's a lot of miscarriages that occur, particularly in the domestic violence population when somebody has been strangled. So there's lots of things that what I teach prosecutors and law enforcement is they need to start asking about those symptoms. Did they have trouble with their voice? Did they have pain in their neck? Was it, because we've all hit our arm and it's hurt. We have not seen a bruise, but it was painful, and it's actually there's bruising internally, but doesn't make it to the surface of the skin. And so oftentimes when you do an autopsy, which our living victims don't let us do, obviously, so there's no injury externally, and then you look inside and there's hemorrhaging in the tissue. It never made it to the surface.
Thank you. I didn't want to prolong it, but those kind of evidences are going to probably be very important as this bill goes forward, I would think.
Thank you. Representative Gruenberg and then Guerra.
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying. And I appreciate the intent of the bill. It seems like a good piece of legislation. My only question is, hands are capable of being deadly instruments, dangerous instruments. Mm-hmm. And you're talking here not just about, well, you're talking about really the fact that certain types of assaults are difficult to prove because they don't leave physical evidence as other types of crimes do. And you specifically pointed to strangulation, which is one type of an injury by one type of an instrument, a hand.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other types of injuries that cause death that are similarly difficult to prove?
None that I have come across at this. No, none that I've come across. The thing about the hands, the way our law is defined right now as dangerous instrument, it's anything in the manner what it's used, threatened to be used, or attempted to be used is can cause serious physical injury. And so by saying that hands, a forearm, a ligature, and the manner that it's being used, so I put my hands around your neck and I control the oxygen to your brain, I am using my hands in a manner that is, you know, serious physical injury is a substantial risk for death. I am creating a substantial risk for death. And I'm not aware, I've not experienced other forms of assault that have been difficult in charging as a felony because of lack of injury.
Yeah, because the way the bill is drafted, it's not limited to hands. It can use any other object.
That's correct.
So what you're really focusing on is the type of injury.
What you're focusing on is that something is being applied, external pressure, whether it's a ligature, it's a leg, it's a forearm, it's a hand, something is applying external pressure to the neck, and it's occluding either the blood vessels or the airway passage, preventing the oxygen exchange in the brain.
And so you're saying that this type of an injury should be considered done by a dangerous instrument because it's very dangerous, obviously, and it does not leave physical evidence. My question, which I think you've answered, is that you're not aware of any other type of injury would cause a death and not leave readily apparent physical evidence.
Strangulation and suffocation, no.
But I can think of one that would, and that's some types of poison. But I don't know that much about it. I don't practice. The only reason I know something about it is one of the cases arose out of a death of a divorce, where they actually threatened me. It was the first case of terroristic threatening. It involved a guy who was the name of the case is Conrad versus the state, and Mr. Conrad had a profession that was very interesting. He was a radio announcer in the sky who said, you know, there's traffic on the Glen Highway. And he had the foolhardiness to make a threat to my client over the telephone.
I know this case.
And said find yourself dead, and I'm going to be in the air at the time.
This woman has contacted me, by the
really?
Way. Really? We'll talk about it later. But
no
yes.
kidding.
However, with poison, whether the person dies or not, you can still do a toxicology samples to be able to test the tissue, you know, the organs, the blood, the urine, to see if there's any types of poisons in their system. You can't do a lab test to test for strangulation.
Are there any, if I may ask one more question, are there any types of poison that don't leave readily detectable residue?
That's beyond the area that I look at. I'm sorry, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, Max.
Hey, Representative Kira?
They're far out there.
You forgot.
Hey.
By now.
Representative Groomer started going down a road that I went down last night when I had concerns, questions about the bill, but they've all been answered. At first blush, the bill looks like it is turning hands into a dangerous instrument, and therefore you would worry that maybe we'll just say every time there's an assault with a hand, it becomes a felony. But this is a very specific, very limited type of use of hands that's very dangerous, which is strangulation. And the reason why it's important, I think, to pass this bill is that it's not so much the cases where strangulation result in death or very serious injury, because those are already prosecuted as felonies. It's the cases where somebody is, during a rape or other assault, strangled. The person isn't left with permanent physical injuries. They were almost killed. They could have been killed, possibly during a rape. But without the evidence of any lasting marks, that might be prosecuted as a misdemeanor. And so So after thinking through the bill, I mean, it makes all the sense in the world. What you're trying to do is find a way to up what was possibly almost a death, what might have been part of a rape, what was part of a very serious crime that leaves no marks and leaves no great injury, into a felony. So I think it's a wise way to do it.
Thank you, Ms. Henry. Okay, Annie Carpinetti.
I represent the criminal division, and I really don't have anything to add to the discussion this morning except that the department worked on this bill, supports it, and I'm available to answer questions if you have any.
Questions? You're off the hook today.
Thank you.
Thanks. And Tamara DeLucia is also on the line. Tamara, are you there?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm testifying on behalf of the Office of Victims' Rights. As a former domestic violence prosecutor and a current victim advocate, this is a bill I feel personally very strongly about, and I can speak from experience when I tell you that strangulation is undercharged and underprosecuted, particularly in the domestic violence context, because the injuries are not readily discernible. And I was a domestic violence prosecutor, so this is very particularized information. Lack of physical evidence has caused the criminal justice system to treat many choking cases as minor incidents, much like a slap on the face where only a little bit of redness occurs. And many are prosecuted as misdemeanors, particularly in the DV context. Strangulation is one of the most deadly methods of controlling a victim, as Ms. Henry explained to you. And the Seattle Washington Journal of Forensic Science published an article in 1985 on strangulation injuries, where it reported that it takes 11 pounds of pressure on the carotid arteries for 10 seconds to cause unconsciousness. And 11 pounds of pressure from a human hand, an adult hand, is hardly any pressure at all. Brain death will occur in 4 to 5 minutes if that pressure persists. So it's a pretty swift method of controlling your victim. Strangulation injuries are very difficult to see upon initial officer contact because the telltale signs such as difficulty swallowing, symptomatic voice changes, and others only develop a day or two after the event. There are mental changes that manifest as early restlessness and combativeness due to the temporary brain anoxia and severe stress reaction. So often when officers get to a scene, the hysterical victim is dismissed as unable to give a coherent statement of what happened, when really what she's experiencing is a very normal symptom of being strangled. That's why this bill is so important. It doesn't require the prosecutor to show physical injuries in order to charge felony conduct, and this should be felony conduct. Strangulation is one of the most lethal forms of domestic violence. Internal injuries may only manifest in several days later, and they may cause death. And domestic violence perpetrators use strangulation to silence their victims. And this should be charged not only as a felonious assault, but also as attempted murder. Strangulation is a form of power and control, and it has devastating psychological effects on victims in addition to a potentially fatal outcome. The Violence and Policy Center and the Uniform Crime Statistics indicate that Alaska is number one in the nation for domestic violence deaths. That's just not a statistic that we can be proud of. I urge you to raise this crime to the level of the severity that it deserves and give the prosecution tools to prosecute these crimes in the manner in which they should be. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Tamara. Questions? Okay, hearing none, is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify on House Bill number 219? There is.
Hi, my name is Peggy Brown. I am the current executive director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I don't know exactly what testimony I could give you here today that would add to what you've already heard. It's been excellent. One thing that I would say is that the network does support this bill. We think it's a long time coming. Several other states have enacted legislation which has to do with strangulation. And on a personal note, I just wanted to let all of you know that this particular bill, I think, addresses the very nature of domestic violence, the very beast of it, the very dark side of it, in that not only is it about power and control, but it's about a person able to take you to be within inches of your life so that you are warned that you should do what I tell you to do or you should do what I ask you to do. And shelter programs across the state deal with this every single day in one form or another, whether it's a family or whether it's sometimes there have been incidences in the villages as well as in the various towns and cities that the shelters serve. So I just wanted to go on the record that we very much support this bill and the very personal nature of the act of strangulation is abhorrent, and we appreciate what this bill attempts to do.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Groomer.
Not for you, but I'd like to ask Ms. Carpinetti the same question I asked a minute ago, if she could come back up. I do support the bill, and I'm not, this hasn't, it just happens to be that the bill brings up an issue which I think may go beyond the bill. We're talking really about types of crimes that are difficult to prove. I think that's what this comes under the category of, not because of problems in the law particularly, but because of evidentiary problems. And the only other kind of a thing I could think of that fell into this category might be certain types of poisons that don't leave residues. And I'm wondering, are there other, I don't, if you want to talk about that or anything else like kinds of assaults or homicides, we don't get into this too often, that just happen to be difficult to prove, and maybe there's something we ought to look at in the law about them.
The chair, I think Ms. Henry is probably in a better position to answer that than I am in terms of forensic evidence, but as a prosecutor, I am not aware of other similar crimes where it is difficult to prove, and I don't know much about poisoning deaths. We don't have many cases like that, but I would be perfectly happy to, you know, talk to our prosecutors and
no, see no, if I don't want to make a problem if none exists. I just thought. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Guerra?
I just have a question. I can envision circumstances where somebody tries to strangle somebody in a domestic violence situation or in a sexual assault. No markings are left. Maybe no lasting damage was caused. Maybe the strangulation wasn't one that the law would call serious physical injury, but it would seem like a lot of the strangulations, even if they don't cause death or permanent injuries, should be prosecuted as felonies now. Why are strangulations, assuming the ones that don't leave a permanent physical injury, why are those not being prosecuted as felonies now? Isn't that not serious physical injury?
Through the chair, the problem is evidentiary, is proving beyond a reasonable doubt when you have no physical evidence to look at whether it is serious physical injury.
So the victim would come in, say, I was strangled, and the jury wouldn't be positive if the victim was telling the truth because there are no markings or something like that.
Through the chair, that's correct. I mean, we wouldn't have carried our burden beyond a reasonable doubt to prove that level of damages.
So are they currently being at least prosecuted as felonies, and maybe juries aren't returning the verdict, but are they being prosecuted as felonies?
Through the chair, Ms. Henry said that they were prosecuted as felonies. We're trying to do that. We're not that successful, and we always have to get an expert witness to testify. So this helps us with those evidentiary matters.
Okay. Anybody else in the audience to testify? One further?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Karen Robinson, and I'm here today representing the Alaska Women's Lobby. And we don't really need to repeat what's been said, except that we appreciate the sponsor bringing this forward. We support it, and appreciate you passing it on through to the next committee. Thank you.
Very much. Anybody else in the audience to testify? Anybody online that I've overlooked? Okay. Hearing none, public testimony is closed. That brings the bill back before us. We have one. Okay. And so we have no amendments. And so, Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kudos to the sponsor. Good bill, and I'm very glad you went out of your comfort zone. Thank you. Madam Chair, I would like to move House Bill 219, Version G, with attached physical notes and individual recommendations, please.
Any objection to that motion? Hearing none, House Bill 219 is moved, and we are adjourned.